Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
Oh, when you hear that music, what can you do? What can you do but salivate? Because you know, ladies and gentlemen, that another episode here, the greatest, a member of the Arcadian Vanguard family of podcasts. It is in the blood. It is the Tennessee Stud. It is episode number 18. It is four generations. It is 93 years. And we're getting the story. And Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, man, can you feel it, brother? Another week is upon us here.
I love it. I'm so ready, Tony. It seems like it's been a month since we were on, and our last show was just tremendous. Gosh almighty. I listened to it myself twice. I liked it so much. I mean, we got to hear Jim Cornette's comments, the great Brian Last with that 605 podcast. Even our boy that just finished that intro there, Dave Summers, had an opportunity to be with us on the program live. The Hall of Famer, Bob Armstrong, Kevin Sullivan. It was 17 was the all-time record for us. We keep setting records, it seems like, every week. And 17 just knocked it right out of the ballpark. And now we're back. I couldn't be more excited about being here again, Tony. It's just great.
You know, Bullet Bob Armstrong in that last episode, just hearing him talk about still wanting to put the tights on, and he's still putting the tights on. He takes such a tremendous care of himself. And hearing you guys tell stories about the good old days, we're going to switch formats a little bit, Stud, this week, because one of the things that we're going to start doing is featuring comments from listeners that we get, as well as the questions we do in the second part. And we're getting ready in your story, as we go chronologically here, to get to a real sweet spot in your story, which is where you put the tights on, and then you take over your own promotion. And we're going to camp in that decade, Stud, I would venture to say, for about a year. I mean, we're going to camp there a long, long time based on some conversations that we have and things that you want to get to. But if you can, Stud, if you don't mind, could I share with you a comment of the week that comes out of Bangalore, India?
Jeez, where'd you say?
Bangalore, India.
Oh, my goodness. Heck yeah. Yeah, let's hear it.
Amazing thing with this internet, this Studcast is reaching all around the world, and it truly is. As it relates to the Stud, it's a worldwide love, and the phenomena of the love of professional wrestling reaches all over the globe. And this gentleman, I'm not even going to attempt, Stud, to pronounce his name, because H.K. Ladakawana, there you go, how's that, H.K., out of Bangalore, India. And here's what he says. He's from Bangalore, India, and he says, I'm a new Tennessee Stud fan from Bangalore, India. Sir, my uncle saw you live back in the day, and your podcast stories have made me go back to when he was alive. Also, over the past 5 years of going after wrestling biographies, documentaries, and ebooks and audiobooks, your podcast cracks me up, and I'm interested in what you have to say the most. So since we haven't had the privilege in this country to witness when a whole lot of wrestling was real, I let people listen to your stories, and they get a whole lot of respect for the history of the industry, even though WWE nowadays is pretty much unbearable. And again, that's H.K. Ladakawana from Bangalore, India, and Tennessee stud Ron Fuller, what say you to that man's comments?
Jeez, I mean, that's pretty amazing. First of all, he's in India. I mean, that's amazing to me. You know, the internet is just a phenomenon. It's unbelievable. This gentleman's from India, and he says his uncle watched me live. And, you know, I got to thank Tony. The only place, the closest place I have wrestled to India is Perth, Australia, which is on the Indian Ocean. It's probably separated from the continent of India by maybe 800 to 1,000 miles. That guy may have come to Perth when I happened to be wrestling in Perth. I wrestled in Perth twice. That's just amazing that he watched. And his English is great. Obviously, they speak English in India. So, you know, it's just amazing. And he's talking about sharing it with other people in India and their respect that they're gaining for it. It just tells me, Tony, that what we do here has much more complexity and much more benefit than what we realize. I don't think about how what we talk about here is going to affect somebody in Bangalore. Was it Bangalore, India? It's just, I'm humbled. I'm amazed and humbled by it. Gosh, just to get any type of comment from somebody in India, especially one like that. So was his name H.K. Ladawana?
That works for me. If that works for you, that works for me.
That's about as close as I get. H.K., thank you so much. I mean, we appreciate it. I do know I see a lot of comments, Tony, Facebook and places like that, and we get tremendous comments. But when we get something like this, it's from another country. It's halfway around the world. The guy's obviously a fan. It's just wonderful. Thank you, H.K., and, you know, I hope we do this every week. I would like to give somebody a little spotlight who has made a great comment. And this is great to start off with somebody from a place like that. That's just amazing. Thank you, HK, so much for listening to us and for appreciating what we do here. And we certainly give our all to it. I feel like, Tony, you and I both, we really love what we do. I mean, just from the bottom of my heart, I love it. I have gotten to where I can't wait for Studcast Day. I can't wait to sit down here and do the deal with you. To get those kind of comments, it fires me up. Man, I want to drop kick somebody. I want to suplex somebody.
You know, Stud, what I think is really incredible, too, in this gentleman's comments, as I look at what he's written here, is he talks about the past 5 years and all the wrestling biographies that are out there and the documentaries that are being made and all the e-books and the audiobooks that are being dropped and all the podcasts that have begun and all those things. And I look at our friend, the great Brian Last, and the success of the 605 and his entire family of people like the great Tom Robinson and different folks like that. And now there's a bunch of Splinter podcasts beginning that he's beginning to birth. And I just think about how there's such a desire for wrestling, and there's still that desire. And then I juxtapose that with the current product. And look, I'm not here to crap on the current product, and neither are you. The current product speaks for itself. People can't get enough, Ron, of when, in the era when you were in the ring. People cannot, and it's not just nostalgia. It's like comparing life and death, as far as I'm concerned. You look back at the product that was, the way the performers were allowed to have the latitude to create from within that ring and hold a crowd in the palm of their hand, to what it's turned into today, which is tremendous athletes, don't get me wrong, but they're just so inhibited by these silly roles, these silly spots, these overdone pyrotechnics, and it's everything but the psychology of what made wrestling the great sport that it truly was. And that's why guys like him and thousands of others thirst for what you're doing, Stud, because you take them back to an era where truly it was real. And I don't think we can say that enough. And I don't think we can celebrate that enough, Stud.
Well, you kind of nail it. And I think there was one line toward the end of his comment there said something about WWE being unbearable. You know, and I'm not going to focus upon that. But I read comments. Since I've started doing a Studcast, I want to learn my craft, and I want to see what other people are doing. There is such a tremendous need and the desire among fans that listen to podcasts about the old stuff. They just want to go back and hearken to that day you're talking about when I wore the tights and a lot of other, thousands of other big-name guys. We were doing it right. we were doing something that will never happen again. And there's a lot of talk there and a lot of feelings about territories. People, a lot of people don't even realize what territories were and what territories mean and what they meant to the sport and what Vince has done to it and what has happened to it nowadays, where it could be. That's what I really focus on, Tony, is where our sport could have been had it not been changed by Vince.
And it's such a terrific point because now and invariably, and I hear Jim Cornette talk on a podcast that you're on a whole bunch, both on his drive-through and then also his regular podcast with the great Brian Lasson. When I hear Jim Cornette talk about the developmental territory that he oversaw for a while there at OVW, and I think about the dearth of developmental territories that there are out there now, and just the overall lack of a living available. Now, the Indy circuit is getting better, but yet it's not going to be what it once was because McMahon purposefully killed that system. And I know it's made him rich and wealthy, but boy, it has created a really boring product at the top of that profession. And that is just, that's a shame. I still will go to a live show every once in a while. I'm not going to be hypocritical. But Ron, it, like the late, great Bobby Heenan said, when you show me the magic trick and then you do the magic trick in front of me, it just loses its magic. And in your era, there's a magic to this. And that's why people hearken back. And that's where we're going to go today. In fact, on the last Studcast, not the anniversary Studcast, but the one previous, we had discussed the time of your family in Arizona, put another red-hot territory together, and now we're getting ready to leave Arizona here, Stud, as we're talking about episode 18. So why don't we pick it up from there as we're leaving Arizona?
All right, great. We left Arizona in 1963, early 1963. Dad had been already looking to expand. He was thinking about expanding that territory from Arizona into Utah. He had made several trips to Salt Lake City, Utah. His focus, again, went upon wrestling. We wanted to go back to the farm when we left Arizona. We did. We went back to the farm in Mississippi for a short period of time, but his focus had become back on wrestling again. And he was somewhat interested in the West, and I'm not sure how he got so focused on the West, but he took us out of school again the early part of 1963, in the fall of 63. He took us out of school again. We went to Denver, Colorado. He had connected with a gentleman in Denver, Colorado, that wanted to have wrestling in Denver. Back in those days, there was very little wrestling in Denver. It was kind of like Arizona had been. It needed someone's hand to take a hold of it and to push it in the right direction and to create that monstrosity of a business that it could become, and nobody had been there to that point. So Dad took us out of school for 3 weeks. We stayed in a motel, didn't go to any school, and he took a real close look at Denver, watched the matches a couple of weeks in a row. I wasn't privy to the conversations. He never sat and discussed things like that with me. I was fairly young, but he did decide this isn't right. It's not right for us. It's not the spot that we want to be. The West is funny. The West, when you think about it, I assume most fans never consider this, but when you build a territory, you drove. Every trip you drove. So when you built a territory, you wanted to be able to access the cities within driving distance of you. Now, when you're out West, it's a lot of landscape and very few major cities. So to build a territory there was very difficult because you didn't have enough cities, and the big cities were separated by such a dramatic distance. So Dad decided to abandon his concept for trying to do something in the West. We came back to the Tennessee. We had then, the Fields brothers had purchased from him 4 years earlier his farm and the business that he'd built, Gulf Coast Wrestling. down there and established it, done a great job with it, turned it into a monstrosity of a territory. It was fabulous for them. They were bragging. I heard him make a comment one time, and he was talking to somebody else. He said the Fields boys bragged about how much more profit they were making because they did not spend near the money that I'd been spending on advertising. And I'm a young boy. I'm paying attention to these things because I'm looking at this is going to be my life. Back in those days, even high school, I really had made a decision that I'm going to be a wrestler someday, and I would love to be a promoter as well. So I paid attention. When he spoke, it was like E.F. Hutton. I mean, that was what he was, an E.F. Hutton to me. I really listened to it, and I really focused on what he was saying. And the guy said, "What do you think that'll do for him?" And he says, "I think that they will die, that their business will begin to die." He said, "If your business isn't growing, it's dying." And I found out when I started my own companies that that was a tremendous statement. He knew his stuff. He really had a grasp on what to do and how to do it. So the Fields boys stopped spending money on advertising. Their business started to shrink. Their crowd started to shrink. And they somehow got themselves in a bit of problem. One of the things that happened in that family is Lee, one of the brothers, had gotten very interested in stock car racing. He built himself a track in Mobile, and they raced not the NASCAR circuit, but the one right below the Busch, I think it's the Busch, raced at his racetrack in Mobile. So his focus on wrestling kind of dwindled away from wrestling, and he really got more involved with his track and doing his racing. The other two brothers, there was a little dispute between them. They kind of broke up the territory that my dad had built into three pieces, and now they're not doing well. And Dad is, we're on the farm. We've gone back from Denver. We're only there for a short period of time. And he says, "Boys, we're going back to Mobile." And I didn't even know why. Then once we got there, I found out, I mean, listening to some conversations, that the Fields brothers quit paying for his territory. They bought it from him. They were paying him over a period of time, and they stopped making payments. They also stopped making payments on the farm that they bought from him. And so he takes us back to Mobile in order to apply pressure to them. He's going to run opposition against the family. And here we are. Now, we experienced this in Memphis with a family feud between Dad and my grandfather, Roy. Now we're experiencing the second family feud between the Fields brothers and my dad. Strange, you know, our family is, I assume there's a lot of families like this. And when you're in a business in which you sell something to someone, and I've had experience with this part of it too, when you sell your company to someone and you don't get all the money for it, you always stand that possibility that it may happen to you that you don't get your money. Now, in this case, he wasn't going to get his money. So we go back to Mobile. We stay in Mobile for about 4 months. He begins to bring his army in. I call them that, his soldiers. Monroe comes back. Galento comes back. He starts to bring his crew, and they panic. The Fields brothers see what's about to happen to him. He's going to take back what they didn't pay him for. And they panic, and they say, "We want to buy you out. Now we want to pay you off for not just your farm, but your wrestling company that we bought from you, or were supposed to have bought from you." And they do just that. They get together a large amount of money. I don't have any idea. I wish I knew all the insides of it, but I'm still a young boy. I'm in high school, a sophomore in high school. And so they buy him out. Rob and I go to a school now. It's called BC Rain. This is like the third high school I have gone to in less than a year. That just shows moving around. We were moving so much and changing schools and changing atmosphere so much. I really loved this school. It was a great school. Beautiful and nice. It was on Dauphin Island, just a kind of an area of an island area just off the mainland of Alabama and South Alabama. I was a basketball player, playing basketball, doing very well. I was a junior varsity player. I was good enough that at the end of this season, the junior varsity was through. Their varsity team was good. They had made it into the playoffs. And their coach came to me and said, you know, I've never done this before. It's never happened in the history of this school, but you're a very good player. And I want you to play with the varsity during the playoffs and as far as we can go. Which is a real compliment for me. I began to see that I had a future in basketball. Sure enough, there was a possibility I had a future in basketball. I was about 6'3" at that point, maybe weighed 140 pounds. I wasn't a big guy by any stretch of imagination, but I was gaining some knowledge about the sport of basketball, and I was being recognized by coaches, and so I felt good about that part of it. It was a wonderful place, but we'd been there maybe 3-4 months, like I said, and all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, like my dad always did, I mean, he never came and said, you know, things may change here. It was always, I'm going to change things this morning. At breakfast one morning, he says, Ron, Rob, you guys need to get your records today because we're moving to Atlanta. And I was like, wow, you know, I love this school. I'm going to play on the varsity's team games. He says, okay, when? And he says, today, we're moving tomorrow. And I'm like, wow. I mean, it uprooted our lives. We got accustomed to that, but it was such a dramatic change for us. And then basically, we take it from there to Atlanta. And Atlanta, this is, you mentioned, I think, earlier here, we're about to change gears here dramatically. I mean, all I have talked about for 17, 18 episodes here is what I can remember as a young boy, what I can remember story-wise, the stories that I have heard. We are about to change the entire landscape of what we do here on the Studcast. We're going to now embark on an era in which I am about to become a part of some of this. I'm going to see this from a grown man's or a young man's perspective. And it's going to really start laying the foundation for what I become as a wrestler and what I become as a promoter. And Atlanta is where it all begins because now I'm a sophomore in high school. We changed schools. I'm now in my fourth high school in basically a year and a half in different place, in a different city. And Atlanta, for people that don't live in the South, Atlanta in 1964. Atlanta is a small, I'm going to say a 500,000. It may be bigger than that, but it may be not. Maybe a 500,000 people in 64. When you drive through downtown Atlanta, you just have a few small buildings off on the right-hand side of Interstate 75 that compromise most, make up most of the city of Atlanta. There's nothing much else there. It's a pretty quick drive right through downtown Atlanta, basically. And to think what happened in that city starting in about 64 and then the next 10 years, that city changed dramatically. And it not just changed with wrestling, it changed with a baseball team, a professional baseball team, a professional football team. It started to evolve into a major city in America. And Dad comes in at a perfect time when wrestling in Atlanta is down some. Let's go back a little bit. I love the history part of all of this, of all of wrestling, especially in the places that I'm very familiar with. There's three promoters there in Atlanta. There is Paul Jones, who was a great old-time wrestler back almost into my grandfather's day, certainly beyond my dad's day. He has a partner named Ray Gunkel, who was a football player at University of Purdue, darn good football player, and a guy named, I'm going to have to think here for just a second, it's the gentleman that my dad bought out. He was a wrestler as well, and he had been there for quite a while, Don McIntyre. Those three guys owned Atlanta, and Paul Jones had been there since 1944. In 1944, he took over the promotion in Atlanta. He was a tremendous wrestler, a tremendous athlete, a specimen of a man. I mean, fabulous build, 6'4", probably 250 pounds. He had long legs like my dad and like I do and like Robert does. And he was a hook scissor king. He used the hook scissor like my granddad And if we hearken back to the Roy story, when Roy got his ribs broken by Dutch Mantell, there was a hook scissor. And Paul Jones applied that hook scissor as well as anybody in the world. He had the long legs for it. And he took a real liking to me because I was tall. I was beginning to be tall. And he said, boy, if you make a wrestler, I want to teach you the hook scissor. And Dad had already taught me the hook scissor. But Paul had a different way of using his hook scissor. Paul Jones becomes a personal friend of mine and my family. Ray Gunkel stays with the promotion for many, many years in the future. There'll be stories about Ray Gunkel down the line here that people will find fascinating what happens in the city of Atlanta. There are great stories when you talk about Atlanta wrestling. And Don McIntyre, my dad buys out, he retires. He's made some money in Atlanta. He's done well for himself. He's been in real estate some. And we go in, and Dad becomes a part of that operation. Before I get too much into the wrestling part of it, Dad does same thing as Roy. Roy had the wrestling company that he built, which was huge, and at the same time, he's building a dairy. He got interested in owning his own dairy. Eventually, he has 1,000 cows, one of the biggest dairies in the South. My dad focuses not on just wrestling, but he begins to take a real interest in buying real estate. He happens to be in one of the hottest parts of the country to buy real estate in because Atlanta is going to explode. Its population will explode in the next 10 years, and he starts to buy real estate. I think we'll take a little break there if you want to. Unless you got some questions, Tony, about this. I mean, I'm covering a lot of ground here. I'm kind of laying groundwork for Atlanta. Now, you had mentioned, and I agree, once we get to discussing Atlanta, we're going to be here in Atlanta for a while because I want to really lay a foundation and I want to explain the history of this great city when it comes to wrestling.
I do want to ask you, Stud, and really great stuff as you bring that to us, about McIntyre. Don McIntyre is a guy, his name's not mentioned much, but you think about it, he's a guy who was a babyface and took on a lot of the heels and really kept that territory going post-Second World War, right into the time on the scene where your father arrives. You're probably talking like a decade and a half there. And then he does decide to get into the real estate world, which inevitably his contributions to that territory as a promoter, as a wrestler, as an owner, as a guiding force behind the scenes are kind of lost to time because he wasn't there for that early wrestling war, that early territory war that we talk about in the early 70s, which is a lot of people focus on that. But what can you share about him? What do you remember about him, your interactions with McIntyre, and even, say, when his wrestling days and his promoting days had come to a close, did you see him down the line when you became active and would go back into the territory? What was your relationship like with Don McIntyre?
I had a better relationship with his other partner, Ray Gunkel. Ray Gunkel was a little bit younger than Don McIntyre. I do have some memories of Don McIntyre. There's a lake north of Atlanta called Lake Lanier. It's one of the most beautiful lakes in the world. Don McIntyre had really made a lot of money. He made a lot of money in real estate. He was ready to get out of the wrestling business, and that's why he sold to my dad to allow my dad to take his spot in Atlanta. But he had the largest boat on Lake Lanier. I mean, to nowadays, I bet you there's some 100-foot boats. There's some $5 million boats on Lake Lanier. That lake was just gorgeous. It was where people in Atlanta went to recreate. And he was one of the first mega people that had the money to have the big, beautiful boat. He took Rob and I and my dad and my mom on his boat one time. I was astounded. I assume it was probably 75 feet long. It had four or five bedrooms. It was air conditioned. It was an unbelievable vessel. Yeah, I know it cost an unbelievable amount of money. Don, I never spent a lot of time with, but there's the other promoter there, Ray Gunkel, that I spent a considerable amount of time with. I used to play tennis with Ray. He was a great athlete. He was a former football player from Purdue, and he was good at everything. He was one of those guys, and he had saved his money. He was a smart guy and a very good wrestler, very good in the ring. And he took a liking to me, too, and he would bring me to his home. He had his tennis backyard, the swimming pool, tennis court. He had it all. And all of those things had an effect on me at a young age. I saw these people that had made a lot of bread, that they had done very well for themselves, and they had done it in wrestling. And it really kind of set a tone for me. It was good for me at that age, and I'm a young guy, early high school, seeing what could possibly and the potential for the sport. And I gained a lot of knowledge from those guys and a lot of experience from them, too.
Yeah, we're getting ready to get into some really fascinating stuff here on the Studcast. You know, a lot of the stuff we've had leading up to this has been great as well. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when the Stud puts those tights on? The behind-the-scenes story that you're about to hear from a guy who's been dubbed by many who should know as the greatest storyteller in the business today. And I'm not just talking about the wrestling business. I'm not talking about the wrestling podcast business. I'm talking about the business. We come back, perhaps we'll lean on the ability to spin a yarn of the great Ron Fuller, as I remind you that you are listening to the Studcast, episode 18, and we're about halfway home. We come back, we'll get some questions in from this audience, and then also we'll get back into Atlanta as we've just arrived in the town, and I know the Stud's going to burn it down. We come back on the other side as you ride with the Stud on the Studcast right after this.
The Studcast continues in 1 minute after these important Studcast offers. Your attention, Stud fans. It's time to ride through the Stud store to have a look at the new blue Studcast t-shirt. This item has been galloping out of the Stud store since its arrival. Both the black and blue Studcast t-shirts are available in all men's sizes, from small to 3XL. These shirts are not only for the men, but for ladies too. And the CD copies of the Studcast are still in production, and we apologize for the delay. When finished, each CD will contain an entire Studcast and exclusive content from the Stud himself for a one-of-a-kind 75-minute experience. These CDs will provide the opportunity to own every Studcast episode forever and create a collector's edition that will be priceless as the episodes continue to roll out. The CDs will allow anyone to enjoy the Stud stories in another format when traveling or relaxing at home. Also coming soon, a DVD of Stud matches from the Continental Wrestling Days, taken from the world-famous Continental Championship Wrestling tapes from 1985 to 1987. Many matches and interviews never before available. Thanks to all of you and the Stud Nation for your support of this phenomenon called the Studcast. So, saddle up every week and tell your friends about the podcast industry's new star, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Find out more at tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com. You are back, seated ringside, on this edition of the Ron Fuller Studcast.
Welcome you back on your Studcast with your Tennessee Stud, your fearless host, Tony Basilio, along with you. And a couple things, Stud. We're going to get into some questions here. Before we go, though, I know you want to say a few more words, though, about the early days in Atlanta. So, Stud, we're back for more. Take it away, my man.
Well, you know, in laying the foundation for Atlanta, I think a lot of it has to do with what's about to happen in the city of Atlanta. There are a lot of cities across the country, and let's just take Tennessee cities as an example. Memphis is there, Nashville is there, Knoxville is there, Chattanooga, four major cities in the state of Tennessee. During this same 10-year period of time, they're not going to experience an explosion in population. Neither is any city in the southern United States, and maybe no city in America is going to grow in the years between 64, 74, 75, like Atlanta does. And I was fortunate enough to be there and to see it and to experience it. It was a phenomenal thing. And then the wrestling does it just like the city itself. I mean, they had experienced some really good years from Paul Jones there in 1944, who actually starts the business and one of the first people to get into the National Wrestling Alliance, becomes a part of the National Wrestling Alliance early on at its formation in 1948. And he is a fixture there, right straight through into my dad's day. He owns a small part of it by the time my dad comes in, but when he is no longer a part of it, even back into the late 60s and early 70s, he's still there and a figurehead. People say they announce the promoter, it's always Paul Jones. It's not really Paul Jones that actually does the work and that actually owns most of the company, but they utilize Paul because of his, he was just a phenomenal person. He had a charisma about him. And I put, you know, every week when we do these studcasts, I try to find a picture that's going to correlate with this. And on the website, if you go to the website, which is tnstud.com, and you take your studcast from that website, you're going to see pictures there that have something to do with that particular episode. And I want to put a picture on this particular episode that we're doing of Paul Jones as an early man. And I think fans, if they take a look at this guy, they're going to go, wow, what a specimen. This guy was phenomenal. He was great. He was intelligent. He was smart. He saved his money like the other guys that were involved in the business. And he was really a phenomenal person to sit down and talk to because his life experiences were being a wrestler. He knew my grandfather, Roy, very, very well. He respected Roy immensely and didn't mind telling you how much he did. And he just, with every conversation I had with him, I grew as a man, as a young man. He enlightened me. He set an example for me at an early age of what a wrestler should be and how he should comport himself around everybody around whoever he was with. He was an amazing man, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk some about Paul Jones because I don't think a lot of people mention him in the sport of wrestling, and he has a definitely wonderful spot in this sport's history.
Tell you what they call him. We're in these parts where we do the studcast here in Knoxville and in this type area. They'd call that guy Country Strong looking at him. That's a big bear of a man, that picture you're talking about.
Yes, he is. I'm going to see if I can get that one put on this episode. You go onto the website. You take this episode from the website. Every one of these studcasts are available on the website, and every one of them has a photo that has something to do with it. This one, for as far as I'm concerned, is a Paul Jones for sure.
And he's a guy who you talk about. Many people, sadly, today when they hear the name Paul Jones, think of the later Paul Jones that I'm sure you wrestled probably near at some point throughout your career, if not on the same card, if not against. But we're talking about two completely different individuals. And the Paul Jones that we're discussing here, the promoter Paul Jones and the wrestler Paul Jones, that seems like some of the stuff, the research I've done on him, that's a real tough guy there, somebody you would not want to cross. What were your interactions like? You talked about how he was interesting to be around. What were some of your conversations with Paul Jones like, Stud?
Well, he would like to talk wrestling, and I loved that, you know, because it was right down my alley. I was soaking it up, and every word I was putting it in my mind, he liked to talk wrestling. He liked to talk shooters because he was a shooter. And he came from that shooter era. He came from Roy's era. He came from the 30s. He started early 30s. Roy started in the early 20s. So Roy had more time in the business, but he knew, shooters knew who shooters were. And they had to do it back in the day because there were times you had to use that skill. You had to do some. Sometimes you had to take control of a match in a way in which they don't do anymore. There's no thought of that, and there's no ability on most guys' case of being able to shoot if they even had to. But he's an old shooter, so he wants to talk wrestling, and I'm sitting there eating and gobbling it up. It's lighting me up kind of like a Christmas tree in December. I'm just, wow, I just loved him. He was like a granddad that, you know, my granddad was a crazy old granddad. He was a wild and crazy guy, and so was Paul Jones, but Paul Jones was much more refined. My granddad was much of a very hard-nosed, and he was a cutthroat type of person, and Paul Jones was a gentleman. but a very, very knowledgeable and extremely well-versed shooter. He knew how to do it. And on a couple occasions, I even had the opportunity of wrestling with him. And he showed me hook scissor, and he showed me a way of doing hook scissor that I'd never seen. It was like a present to me. I was just loving it, being in the tutelage of one of the greats.
So how old would you have been? How old would he have been when he's in the ring, and let's just say experimenting with you, maybe stretching you and teaching you some holds? How old would you have been? How old would he have been, Stud?
I'm a sophomore in high school. That's, what is that?
14.
I'm 16,
yeah.
14, 15
yeah.
years
yeah.
old.
Yeah.
He's in his 60s. He's an older guy, but I mean, he's in his 60s, but he's 30 strong. He's like a 30-year-old in strength. He's still got that power. He's still got that drive. He's still got that strength and the stamina. He's an older fella, but he's kind of like Bob Armstrong we talked about earlier, who's still putting those tights on at 78. I'll bet the son of a gun, if he'd lived to be 78 years old, would have had his tights. He could have worn them as well. He was a hoss at that age.
Yeah, and I want the listener of the Studcast to think about this now. You're a 14-year-old kid, as Stud's talking about, and Ron's tall guy and probably real tall kid and selling in basketball, and here's a guy, I'm going to teach you how to do the scissor. He's got you down on the ground, and he could do anything to you he wanted to do to you, and the guy's in his 60s, and if he feels like stretching this kid, he will. That's kind of terrifying. And here's the other thing about guys like him, Stud, is that, you know, at times those guys that learned how to shoot and knew how to shoot, a lot of times they would stretch people for fun, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my dad always had a theory, and he always applied it when he was working out with us, and so did Paul. Paul Jones did the same thing. Dad says, if it don't hurt, you don't remember it. So when they put a hold on you, they hurt you. They want you to scream. They want you to remember it. They want it to hurt so bad that it makes an impression in your brain that says, wow, I want to learn to do this so I can do it to somebody else. And that's a strange damn way of looking at it, but that's what shooting's all about. You don't remember it if it doesn't hurt you. So when he put this hook scissor on me, he would do it in a way that I'd never seen. I'd ask him, he'd hurt me, and I would scream, and he would let me go. He'd say, okay, you all right? Yeah, I'm okay. Do it again. Now, I would say, do it again, because I wanted to make sure I had all the leverage points. When you learn a wrestling hold and you really want to apply it and you really want it to work, you really have to figure out where the leverage points are, how to apply it. It can be, a wrestling hold can be effective by just the direction you turn your hand. Maybe you turn your, he'd say, now when you hook this hook scissor, you want to put your left leg behind his right knee. It was detailed. And when you applied it properly, you felt it as the person applying it, and when it was applied properly, you felt it the other way. It was painful. It really worked. And you had to do it again and again and again and again from both ways. You had to have it applied to you, and you had to apply it on somebody else to really learn how to use every single hole you ever learned.
Believe that. The Stud's bringing it right at you. And if you want to reach the Tennessee Stud, you already heard the Stud mention the website. You're invited to check that out, tnstud.com. Also, if you want to follow the Stud on Twitter, the address is Ron Fuller Welch. And if you want to ask a question of the Stud, you can do so on the Facebook page, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. That's Ron Fuller Tennessee spelled out Stud, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. And Stud, it's about that time for us to get into some questions from listeners. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. I love them.
All right. Brian Huff, St. Paul, Minnesota, AWA territory, wants to know, was Virgil Hatfield really related to the Hatfields from the famous feud, the Hatfields and the McCoys?
Well, that's a good question, but it also happens to be perfect that fits into our program here, because we talked earlier about the Fields brothers. And the Fields brothers, their names are really Hatfield. They are my grandfather's sister, who is named Bonnie. She's married to Virgil Hatfield. They start wrestling, and they change their names to Fields. And I don't know why they changed their names to Fields, but oddly enough, you know, what a great question, because he really is related And I don't know exactly how he's related, but I've asked that question myself of his sons, of Lee. I said, your dad was named Virgil Hatfield. Are you any relations to the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? That was the feud. It was probably the most famous feud in the history of America. It went on for years and years, generation after generation, and they shot each other and whatever they did to each other. I don't know the whole story of it. But Lee said, yes, that I am a Hatfield. I am related to the Hatfields of the Hatfields and McCoys. I believe those, the original people, the original Hatfield and the original McCoy that started the feud, they were Southerners. They lived somewhere in the South, and I don't know where they were. I wish I had the history of all that. You know, and I could probably do a better job answering the question, but Lee confirmed to me that he is a Hatfield from the lineage of the Hatfield and McCoys. Pretty amazing.
And who's going to argue? If he tells you that he's related to him, what are you going to say? No, you're not?
No, and besides that, he might pump a shot into me or something, too. You know, I don't want to make that. If he's a real Hatfield, you know, they didn't have any problem in trying to get even or whatever it was. The feud went on for years. And this feud that happened then, basically in this same program that we're in right here, in this same studcast, it came from that family against my dad. And I assume that their relationship came through their father. Thank goodness it wasn't through their mother, because their mother was a Welch. And that was my part of the family. But the Hatfields, that's a great question. Because you'd have to know something about wrestling to ask that question. I can't believe someone from Minnesota has enough knowledge about the South down there, the wrestling along the Gulf Coast, to know that. But it's a great question.
Source I'm looking at here, Stud, say that the Hatfield-McCoy feud began two rural families, the West Virginia, Kentucky area along Tug Fork and the Big Sandy River from 1863 to 1891. And that's quite a feud. And I don't know what their blow-off was like, but I don't know if they what kind of blow-off they could have had to end their feud, man, when it's 31 years long.
Yeah, that's crazy. Can you imagine feuding with a family for 31 years? But I assume that I bet there's a lot of deaths involved in that feud between those two families. Has to be quite a few people that got killed. And I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that the way it ended is the families married. One of the males married a female from the other family, and it finally, by them marrying into a family together.
That is some classic stuff indeed. Let's go to our next question. And again, we want to thank Brian Huff from St. Paul, Minnesota, who led us into a history lesson, which is the essence of what we do here on your Studcast. Next question up comes from my neck of the woods, Arrowmore, Pennsylvania, as I hear just outside of Philadelphia. I must say to Philip Allen, sir, I've never heard of where you're from, Arrowmore, Pennsylvania, who says the following. I'm a huge fan of yours, from wrestling to hockey, and I was wondering why you didn't do more with black wrestlers in the 70s and 80s, and looking back, would you do it differently when you saw the Junkyard Dog in Mid-South? Did you think, man, I need a black star too?
Wow. Great question. Jeez, these people are good. I'll tell you, Tony, these people are good. That's a tremendous question. You know, I had to give it a little bit of thought here for a second. First, let's answer the first one there. It looks like he's got I must have two questions here. So in the 70s and 80s, why didn't I use more? I guess he asked, why did I not have more black wrestlers? Let's start with Southeastern Wrestling in Knoxville. East Tennessee, I was living in Knoxville. My territory basically ran from Chattanooga north into almost to the Ohio border. We went into West Virginia. We wrestled a lot in eastern side of Kentucky and obviously in the eastern side of Tennessee. Oddly enough, there weren't a lot of black people in those parts of the country. I don't think that the black population is really large in that particular part of the country. So I'm running a wrestling company that's in that part of the country. I'm trying to figure out how I can interest and gain fans, because most of the people that live there are white. Then I guess probably without really thinking a lot about it, I didn't have a lot of black wrestlers because I don't think that I would have done as well there as what I did, because you need that interest. You need that star that's going to come from the segment of society that most of your fans are. And there were white fans in that part of the country. Now, I did use black wrestlers in Knoxville. Norvell Ost, a great example. I used Norvell a lot. Pez Watley. I used a guy named Pistol Pez Watley. I did have some blacks in Knoxville and in that first Southeastern company that I owned because I wanted to. I thought we needed a mixture, and I liked their talents mostly because I liked their ability. Norvell Austin was one of the great workers of all time. He was fabulous in the ring. So was Pez. Pez Watley was a great worker. So I used those guys, but I didn't have a whole lot of other people like he talked about because I wasn't in the right part of the country. So 5 years later, I go to Knoxville. I create Southeastern Wrestling in 1974. In 1978, I buy another part. I buy the Fields Brothers out along the Gulf Coast. Now we're talking about a different entity. Now we're talking about South Alabama, all of Alabama, Mississippi, over into close to New Orleans. You're talking about a larger black population now. You've got quite a few blacks that live in that part of the country. And then I started to use more. I started to bring in guys like I used Thunderbolt Patterson. I even used Thunderbolt some in Knoxville. But Thunderbolt became a bigger star for me in Southeastern Wrestling once we moved into Pensacola and we started operating along the Gulf Coast through the states of Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. We started drawing more and more blacks because there was a larger black population. Sonny King, great wrestler, great athlete. Larry Hamilton, a guy that just died last week or within the last 2 weeks, who is named Burrhead Jones. I want to say something about Burrhead Jones. Burrhead Jones was a guy from Montgomery who was one of the all-time best guys to do business with that I ever did business with in wrestling. He was the type of guy who gave you his best every time he went into the ring. He didn't have the skills and the ability to win a lot of matches, but he certainly had the heart. And I used to use him a lot because I loved his heart. I loved what he did, and his drive and his enthusiasm in the ring was just absolutely phenomenal. And saying this for Burrhead, he is one of the greats. I really loved Burrhead. He was a personal friend of mine, my brother's, Jimmy. He wrestled for Jimmy's dad in Montgomery for so many years. He's a phenomenal guy. I'm only saying this because he just recently died. I want to pay tribute to Burrhead. Burrhead was a phenomenal talent. So I did use the black guys once we got to Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola. And just to finish this, he mentions Junkyard Dog, okay, as being the black that just exploded Mid-South Wrestling. Mid-South Wrestling basically is from New Orleans, Louisiana, through the state of Louisiana, into the state of Oklahoma. It was run by Bill Watts before him. It was run by Danny Hodge. That's Danny Hodge country. It's Jack Briscoe country. It's Bill Watts. Bill Watts built Mid-South. That was his company. He did a tremendous job. Junkyard Dog's name is Sylvester Ritter. And I discovered Sylvester Ritter. Sylvester Ritter came and wrestled for me, oddly enough, in Knoxville. Sylvester Ritter was a talented, phenomenally talented black wrestler, and I did not have a spot for him because my population that I was trying to work to were white. And I called Bill Watts and said, Bill, I have a black guy here, and he is great. He's going to be a monster talent. And Bill and I had been friends for many years. I said, I want to send him to you if you'd like to have him. And he says, Ron, if you recommend him, I know you well enough that I'm going to take him. And he took Sylvester Ritter, changed his name, put a dog collar around his neck with big spikes coming out of it, put a chain on that he took to the ring with him. And that guy just tore it up over there for Bill Watts. He became the biggest star, Bill Watts, and probably one of the biggest stars in all of wrestling, and he came from me. He came from Knoxville. We discovered him, and we basically gave him to Bill Watts, and Bill made a ton of money for Sylvester and a lot of money for himself and all those wrestlers that were there and a part of that era for Bill Watts. They owe a heck of a lot to Junkyard Dog.
It's interesting to hear you talking about the Junkyard Dog and how he was able to transform and become such a huge star there, and that concentration of the black population in that territory, there's no doubt about it. In fact, you think back to New Orleans Saints and who dat say, that comes from a Junkyard Dog. Who dat say gonna beat that dog? But more to the point, I remember growing up in the Northeast where I did. Bruno Sammartino was a big deal. Why? That tremendous Italian population that had settled in those northeastern cities and the old WWWF. And then you also had, when I was a kid, Pedro Morales was huge. Why? Because of the huge Puerto Ricania population as well in the Northeast. So it only makes sense and stands to reason what you're discussing there. But a couple of great questions, Brian Huff and Philip Allen. And then our comment of the week, the gentleman from Bangalore, India. Stud, who is going to get the autographed picture this week of the stud? And I know for a fact that these are passed out. How do I know? A friend of mine, Dwayne Light, tweeted at me after he received his package from you, Stud. And, boy, he was over the moon, elated and excited that you had, in fact, sent him an autographed photo. So this does happen. Stud, who's winning this week?
I'm going to have to go with the gentleman from Pennsylvania. His question is just great. Gosh, I love these questions, Tony, because they take me to places that I have no idea where I'm going to go. And this question that he asked, it just really makes me think about, you know, why I did what I did and why I had so few blacks in Knoxville and more blacks in there. You know, since you mentioned Bruno and you mentioned the other gentleman, Australia, you work to the people that live in your area. You try to design your wrestlers to fit them. They did a great job in Australia. Jim Barnett in Australia had Spiros Arion to speak to his Greeks. He had Mario Milano to speak to the Italians. I mean, he had these wrestlers from different parts of the world, and when they did their interviews, they didn't do them in English. They spoke directly. Arion spoke Greek to the Greeks, and Milano spoke Italian to the Italians. It was a phenomenal way of doing business. You catered to your people that were there, to your population that you were dealing with. And that's kind of what I did in Knoxville.
And we cater here on the Studcast. We're out of time, but we cater to you. Why? Because we know you love the old school, and you know you love it. We know that you love it presented in a way that is respectful to the history of wrestling, and that's exactly what we do here on the Studcast. Stud, we're out of time, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it's been great. It's always great. And Josh, it just flies by. There's a lot of people I have, real quickly, Tony, a lot of people say, you know, content. They want more content. They want longer programs. I mean, what we do is basically what everybody does with a Studcast. I'm thinking now about other things that we might be able to do, and I'm hopefully able to talk within the next couple of weeks about more content, different content. I got so much inside me that I'm just storing. It's just sitting there waiting for me to get to certain years, and I'm thinking about ways that we might be able to start to offer these people a longer show, maybe as long as 2 hours, with a deep dive in which we really take one person and really get to tearing it all apart so that people go, wow, this is unbelievable. I never knew this kind of stuff. We're just really starting here. I'm just so enthusiastic about it, Tony. We turned the corner here. We're in Atlanta. We're going to go so many different directions here, and we're just being able to do this is just phenomenal. I love it every week.
So when we come back, we're going to head right down I-75 and I-95, and we're going to pick it up in the great city of Atlanta with the Tennessee Stud. In the meantime, for the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I want to remind you, should you choose to connect with the Stud, remember the Stud store over at tnstud.com and all the goodies there. On Twitter, Ron Fuller Welch. On Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. Get engaged, get involved, Become a Team Stud member and share the word on what we do here on the Studcast. In the meantime, for the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, this is Tony Basilio reminding you that you can find me over on Twitter at Tony Basilio, also at TonyBasilio.com. I do a radio show in Knoxville, Tennessee, each and every day. Post-game stuff during the Tennessee football and basketball season, and a Southeastern Conference show Sunday nights from 7 Eastern until 9 Eastern, wherever you may view or hear. Actually, look for it on Periscope. In the meantime, for the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, Tony Basilio saying, I hope you have a stud-filled week. We love you. God bless. Talk to you next time on your Studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.